Okay, so I think we'll go over to José Luis Fernandez, and let's see if you can find yourself.
Thank you very much. And thank you for the invitation to come today. So this is the title of my presentation, using longitudinal data to assess long-term care funding arrangements. And the aims of the presentation are, first of all, just to make a few comments about the relevance, the importance of having longitudinal data when assessing social care funding arrangements. Then I would like to talk a little bit about some of the work that we've done on the basis of a dynamic factor simulation model to look at. Oops, I've just turned this off. Fantastic. Hey, it's coming back. Perfect. So I'll talk a little bit about the matrix simulation model that we've got here, how we built it, which sort of data we've used, which sort of assumptions we've needed to make, what its limitations are, etc. And of course, I'll finish with some caveats, limitations, and challenges for future researchers. We should always finish our presentations asking for further research and, if possible, further funds for research. So in terms of the relevance of longitudinal data for the analysis of long-term care funding, this is, in a sense, is obvious. From one perspective, in terms of, what do we use these models for? We use these models to look at what the demand for long-term care services will be in the future, to try to understand how many services we'll need to purchase, who's going to pay for them, etc. And therefore, in order to go into the future, we need to look back, and we need some sort of evidence about what the trends have been in terms of some key changes, for example, in terms of need, in terms of service provision, in terms of population changes, unit cost, etc. So certainly we need, at that sort of aggregate level, we need longitudinal data in order to inform our assumptions about what is likely to happen in the future and to embody those assumptions into our models. But more interestingly, I think, it's also about the nature of long-term care. Long-term care is, by definition, something that people receive on a regular basis. It's a long-term service. And actually, therefore, the cumulative effects are very important, because this is not some sort of acute intervention that you're going to have. It's going to take, 3 days. You need to measure what happens over those 3 days, and then that's it. People are going to be receiving services over a period of time, and they're going to be interacting with us, with the system, over a period of time. And critically, the nature of that interaction will vary depending on the circumstances. And those circumstances, as I'll illustrate a little bit later, can vary. And therefore, it is important to observe, and when you look at the performance of the funding system, not just to look at how that system does for particular people at one point in time, but see how that system follows people through time and what the lifetime, as it were, effect of different funding arrangements are. And actually, this is reflected in some of the recent policy developments. The dealing of proposals, which I'll talk a little bit more about later on, are actually just, in a sense, reflecting these. They're saying, that we need to have funding arrangements which take into account what's happened in the past to people and how much they've had to contribute. Well, you need longitudinal data in order to understand how you can design such a system, and how much that system is going to cost, what sort of effect, what sort of outcome it's going to have. Now, this is a slightly cryptic and not very cheerful title for a slide. And this is just carrying on the similar sort of of theme. In England, we've got a means tested system. That system basically will help you if you've got less than £23,000 worth of assets. And so eventually, if you live for a very long time and you've got needs for a very long time, eventually the system is going to protect you. It's going to actually pay a lot of your care. So, in the long run, we're all dead, and we're all covered by the system. But what you want is actually to understand the trajectory of people. Yeah. So you want to understand. And for that, again, you need longitudinal data. You need to have something which tells you how people move through the system, how they interact with it across their lifetime. And this is just an illustration of that in terms of I would consider a pretty graph, might disagree. It took me an hour this morning, it wasn't working. Anyway, so just imagine Mrs. Smith, there's no Mrs. Smith here. Mrs. Smith, she's in the community, needs to go into residential care, something happens, and after the, you know, this is time, we're following her for 62 months, and second month she goes into residential care, she's got £100,000 worth of assets, she doesn't have accessible income, and she's going to stay in residential care there for 5 years. And, you know, the residential care home costs £1,500, is an average sort of residential care. Now, you see that the system is actually going to be quite harsh at the beginning, because she's got more than £23,000 worth of assets, she's going to have to pay for the full cost of the care, so the £2,500 per month. That's illustrated by red there, those are the charges. Then those assets are going to be depleting, the assets are illustrated by the blue. You see how they're depleting fast, they start at 100,000 and they quickly go down, you know, here. So by the 31st month, they're close to £20,000. Yeah, that they're being depleted very fast because the person is responsible for 100% of them. Then, from that point on, that's the beautiful preface that we've got in the Minster State system in England. And therefore, the system changes completely at that, from that point on. The person doesn't have any accessible income, just for simplicity's sake. So the person only has to pay a proportion of her assets, 1/250th per week. Yeah? And therefore the asset depletion from then on is much more limited, and most of the care charges are paid for by the state. Now what I'm trying to illustrate there simply is that the same person is going to have a very different experience at different points in time in her life. And that if you want to understand how well that system is doing for that person, you want to understand all that path. Because the person at the end of the day is not paying almost anything of the care, but she's lost 80% of her wealth. Okay, so and of course, if you want to get to that funding side, the funding element, you have to go through a lot of. It's a complicated process, because in order to understand what people are going to end up paying, you first have to understand what their needs are, how many of those people there are, what their needs are. You know, what sort of informal care they're going to have, what sort of demand they're likely to have first, are they going to be offered any care, if so, are they going to take it, and so on. So it's a complicated system that you need to model, and you need data for, you know, in order to build those assumptions about what's likely to happen to somebody through their life. How much are unit costs going to change? But, you know, with Raphael, we have this conversation on a yearly basis, and, you know, it's always the same sort of technique that we use, you know, to make the assumptions. Well, it's just very difficult. And one of the conclusions of the talk is that we need more evidence. So you need to model all these things in order to really get at the modeling of the funding system. And I don't know if you'd be surprised about this, but if you look at, for example, just something which is critical to care, which is how people's needs change through time, and this is just taking two waves of the BHPS, the British Hospital Blood Panel Survey, and just looking at all the people, looking at their ADLs. You can define them in different ways. This is just simply an addition of the number of ADLs. There's six, I think, in BHPS. And just group them by whether you've got no ADLs, you're green, one or two ADLs, yellow, and three or more. And you actually see that, you know, the transitions are not perhaps what I certainly was expecting when I first looked at this. You see that, okay, you know, the majority of people who in wave 12, and this happens across all waves, eh? This is just an illustration. Most of those people who have no ADLs, or the people will end up without any ADLs in the next phase, but you see how, you know, at least 22%, so almost a quarter of people who are really dependent have zero dependency by the next wave. And so there's a lot of instability in the patterns of care through time. Now that's important in terms of, you could wonder, well, is this simply because the data is not right? But you know, having spoken to Carl Jagger, for example, who's, you know, a top epidemiologist looking at exactly this is the sort of thing that she expects. So big changes through time, and the question is, are you able to get the evidence in order to model these properly into your analysis? Okay, so and at that point, I want to illustrate how we've had a go at doing this. On the basis of this dynamic microsimulation model. I've got to, of course, mention Jules, who most of you would know. And so in terms of its micro, it's a model that we've used, we've built in order to look at funding, but that incorporates all those assumptions that I was talking about. And it's micro in that we can look at individuals and therefore at distributions across groups of individuals in society. And it's dynamic in that we actually age people through time. Okay, so and the dynamic component is particularly important if what you want to do is to analyze funding systems which have got some sort of memory, time memory in them, like a limited liability. Like, you know, you've been 3 years receiving time, therefore something will happen, or you've paid all this, therefore, you know, you need therefore some sort of dynamic component to your model. In terms of data sources, and I'm not going to describe my data half as a tenth as detailed as you did. Just basically, I'm going to say we've pooled 13 waves of EHPS in order to have a lot of cases in our analysis. We've reweighted all that sample in order to make it look as the cross section of all the people in England at the moment. Originally, we based the model on ELSA, and we will probably go back to ELSA at some point once we've got enough waves to have enough cases to, because the data is going to be better eventually in terms of ELSA. So, model structure. Basically, what we do is, as I was saying before, we pulled BHPS, we reweighted. It looks like the English cross section of all the people in terms of key indicators like health, disability, population distribution, of course, age and gender. But also things like wealth, these are very important, wealth and income, and other personal characteristics, including cohabitation, for example, which is very important in terms of informal care. And then what happens is that we make some assumptions, which I'll talk about very briefly in a second, about how the system responds and how the individuals respond. And then from the model, we get some outputs about levels of utilization of services, levels of costs to both the state and the individual, and changes in personal circumstances. So, how is your, are you going to die? Are you going to have a change? What's going to happen to your disability, etc. And we get indicators as a result of unmet need and well-being at the moment. Now we're incorporating indicators of well-being. So we need to clearly impose into the model some rules about how the system works in terms of what are the eligibility criteria, what are the funding rules, the charging rules, etc., the targeting of disability benefits, attendance allowance and disability living allowance in particular, but also income support rules, etc. So we need to model all that. We then need to have assumptions about how individuals react to the funding system, because it's very important that we acknowledge the fact that different funding systems will not just change how who pays for what, but also who gets what, because people, if you ask them to pay more than they want to, will decide not to have services. I'm just going to skip that one. And so what we do is then, at the end of the year, once we've reached that stage, we transition the model. So we transition population. We just basically say, okay, so what are your chances? First of all, we decide whether you die. There's a dummy in the model that kills you at 107. You will not be older than 107 in the model. We decide whether you die, then we decide what your dependency is. Depending on that, and you will be offered or not residential care, you will take it or not. If not, you will be offered some community-based services. You might take them or not, depending on your preferences, etc. And so on and so on. Then, we do this for 20 years. Or 40, or until everyone dies, if what we're looking at is lifetime, sort of. We try to calibrate our models. All these transitions, you have to make assumptions. You have to look for longitudinal data, which will tell you how, given your characteristics, given your need, given your family circumstances, given your wealth, you might react. Yeah? But that is quite a, by definition, is quite an unstable sort of thing. Those probabilities that you either randomness, implicity in them. So you need to calibrate the model so that it actually hits some big aggregate levels which you think it should be hitting. And so we use things like projections about mortality from the ONS, about benefit uptake, you know, information from the information center about expenditure, service use, and number of recipients of services in of social care services in England. We look at different sources of income and wealth in order to triangulate our results. Okay, I'm just gonna. These are some of the assumptions, some of the key assumptions that we make. For example, at the moment, we're still making an assumption that the prevalence of disability, age and gender specific, remains constant. That is probably an optimistic assumption, in that people are, you know, some of the latest evidence suggests that actually that might be slightly optimistic. There might be even more dependency in the future. The prevalence of disability might increase in the future. We make that the assumption that in the long run we're talking about 2% increase in the need cost, not in the short run given where we are in the economy. We have to make assumptions about wealth and income changes. We reckon that income will grow in line with unit costs. We have to make assumptions about informal care. At the moment, we're freezing those relationships. The propensity to provide informal care is assumed to be remain constant. And then we have to make assumptions about disability uptake. These are just some of the aggregate consequences of those assumptions. So if you look at the distribution of our population, and you group them in terms of need, these are people with three or more ADLs, more or less, although these are imputed ADLs, so there's slightly different sort of currency. But you see how, you know, mortality clearly is driven by amongst other things, disability. This is something that is absolutely critical to the cost of many funding systems, such as the Vilmar proposal, which is the survival of people in residential care. This graph illustrates what the survival of residents is censored in 20 years. We estimated this on the basis of BUPA data. We ran some survival analysis models, some Poisson models on cross regressions, and it suggests that the median length of stay in residential care is just over 1 year, median. Of course, this varies by gender and other factors. And that by, you know, just above 2 years is the average survival in residential care. And this is very important, because residential care is what really will grab at your assets, because it's £30,000 per year. Okay, these are just some aggregate outputs from the model in terms of numbers of people by levels of need. You'll see that overall, you know, the majority of the number of other people do not have ADLs at any given point in time. You see that the growth in actually the proportion of people with high needs is projected to slightly rise, and as I was saying before, it's likely to rise even further because our assumptions are probably conservative in terms of this. This is in terms of, that was need, that was numbers of people with levels of need. This is in terms of expenditure, breaking down by private expenditure, the red bit. Dependents' allowance, disability living allowance, the disability benefits, and then personal social services care expenditure for all the people. And these are slightly old estimates, but they haven't varied much from the latest assumptions. And so you see that the state, for example, would spend from 6 billion to, what is it, 12 billion, double in that period, more or less. You see how private expenditure will grow more if you don't change the funding system, because more and more people who are homeowners will be excluded by the current means test, for example. So that's quite useful from an aggregate point of view, but of course what is very important as well is to look at the individual. And so you can look at, for example, the lifetime. I don't know whether this surprises you or not, but if you manage to get a model like this, then you can get an estimate of the lifetime expenditure, social care expenditure. Depending on what assumptions you make about the growth in unit costs, but if you take the top table there, if you include care and hotel costs, so the costs of related to the accommodation in residential care, we estimate that on average we're talking about £50,000 on average per person, for all the person, everyone on average, £50,000. I mean, it's pretty high. It might be much higher for women. No comment. You can then get a distribution of lifetime expenditure. Okay, so you can say, so okay, so if you take the cross section of 65 year olds today, how much have I got? Another five minutes?
Yeah,
five. Exactly. Four. Three. This shouldn't have asked. I had five before I asked. So you can actually look at the distribution. You can say, okay, so if we look at the cross section of 65 year olds today and we age them until they die and we count how much care needs they're going to have and the value of that, well, this is the sort of distribution you get. What does that mean? That there's about a quarter of people who will not use social care services. Then there's a small minority, about 10%, who will need more than £100,000 worth of care. Now, that might be seen as unfair, because why, you know, you're unlucky, you're in that side of the distribution, and then you're faced with £100,000 or more of care costs. That might disincentivize people to save. You know, there's no way of insuring ourselves privately, so the state should step in. Well, that's the sort of Vilna Commission's argument. I'm just going to skip that. You know, the model will give you all sorts of outcomes. But I just wanted to then link those sorts of results to the Vilna proposals. Andrew Dillner was asked to look at how to come up with a partnership, i.e. asking individuals to contribute. I think that's the way I read it. In such a way that you end up with a system that protects people against those catastrophic costs. But in order to do that, you need information about what the likely distribution of those catastrophic costs is. And therefore, you need longitudinal data to understand what the pattern of utilization and pattern of charges will be. He therefore came up with this recommendation for a cap, so that, you know, people will have to contribute £35,000 worth of care costs, but from that point, the state will pick up the tab. Of course, you know, you still have to pay £10,000 per year of hotel costs if you're in residential care, because those are accommodation-related costs, they're not care-related costs. And so basically that was the state will pick up, will make sure that anything above here, those 35,000, will be looked at. It won't be your responsibility anymore. The proposals themselves, when you aggregate that up, then how much does it cost? Are not that expensive. They're less than £2 billion in 2010. If they were to be implemented today, which in the context of £400 billion worth of public expenditure is not that huge for a big reform, and growing to £3.6 billion by 2025-26. And most of that money would be then concentrated on higher income groups. This graph is just saying, is just looking at the pale blue is current expenditure, the darker blue is the additional expenditure, and that's grouped by income quintile. And you see how most of the additional expenditure will be concentrated on people with high incomes. It's not surprising, it's the people who are not served at the moment and who are therefore at higher risk of catastrophic expenditures. Just going to skip this, given that I've got now 3 minutes. Okay, so this is my last slide, actually. So I'll just take 1 minute. Having illustrated all these results and exciting, I think, analysis, you're half asleep, but you know, we'll play it. It is also important to illustrate some of the caveats. Clearly, there is huge uncertainty surrounding many of the assumptions that we've made. You know, assumptions about prevalence of disability, we don't know really what's going to happen. And this is hugely important in terms of even population, which is the simplest assumptions, things you can look at. We systematically get it wrong. We underpredict increases in life expectancy. So unit costs, we don't know what's going to happen to them. And therefore, you know, we have to take a pinch of salt, you know, the results that, with a pinch of salt, the results that come out of these models. And I think we have to find better ways of illustrating that uncertainty. I think these models are much stronger in terms of comparing two systems, rather than telling you what is likely to happen in 20 years' time in terms of the current system, how much would you need to spend. Because the uncertainty around every single one of these assumptions is so significant. If they were to ask me, I would say, you know, don't believe anything. You know, if there is any difference between two models which is less than £500 million, you know, just ignore that. It's not significantly different. You can buy lots of things with £500 million, but these models can't really tell you. Anyway, so and we need a lot more evidence, I think, about in order to populate these assumptions. So, you know, we need more research and obviously funds for it. Thank you very much.
Thank you. After the conference, I'm going to ask him for a loan of $500,000.
Small change. So, just got time for discussion now. Any quick questions to ask these? First of all, what's the clarification?
Just a quick question. It's very nice to know about the prediction model. Do you know, because it has been running for many years, do you then look at the actual threshold from then updating the model or running backward and see how different and adjust?
What we do is the model starts in 2007. And so the model is calibrated in such a way that it will hit the years that we've got evidence for. So, you know, we now have 4 years worth of evidence in terms of expenditure and users. And although, you know, the dynamic approximation models tend to be slightly unstable the first couple of years, but then they stabilize, you know, because the transitions. And so what we do is to check that for the period of time that, you know, until we've got data that is hitting those sorts of targets. Then the other thing is that obviously we've got all these markers that we want to be hitting. So if we make an assumption of the constant prevalence of disability, for example, we then double check that all those markers are being hit. Yeah.
Okay. Any other quick points of clarification? We've got time for. Okay. So let's go to a general discussion. We can come back to Shireen's and Elise's presentation if necessary. But just thinking about the four presentations we've had. And the illustrations that were given in those, in each case, the speakers were talking about inherently longitudinal issues. So Jose Luis is obvious because, you know, he was asked and is passionate about making projections into the future. And if you're going to plan a long-term care financing system, then you're not passionate about it.
He's sad.
but you know, we need to have that longitudinal perspective because we have to plan our system on the basis of that. Shireen is very interested in how those characteristics of providers and employees change and what's happening in relation to rates of staff turnover, which is such a disruptive issue in the, you know, very relational nature of social care. And then this morning we heard about, again, examples of studies which are addressing inherently, voice holds up, longitudinal questions. Now, in contrast to that, when Shireen and Hazaris and I were talking about the contents of the presentation, actually there aren't very many longitudinal studies in social care. And I don't know why, but there just hasn't been very much. And so out of today, I hope that we can get some energy to see more of that. So one of the things for today was just to bring the studies to your attention, bring the ideas to your attention, hopefully to stimulate some further thoughts for further work. So I just want to use those remarks to throw this open to you. What are the things that particularly excite you, worry you, completely mystify you, made you fall asleep in those recent presentation, whatever it is, what are those things? You know, what do we do now, thinking about social care and the longitudinal design perspective? So any comments, questions, suggestions, open to you. They're all sharp ones.
I'm looking at the social determinants of mental health in different labour market and welfare state regimes in the UK, Germany and Sweden, and I'm interested in using longitudinal data for that, but I'm sort of really at the beginning of planning my study and I'd be advised to you to just do a cross-section because it might be too complicated. But I was just wondering, in terms of a cohort study exploring individuals, if there's studies in different countries and what their sort of level of comparability is in terms of the questions being asked. Like, for instance, sort of different conceptualizations of what mental health is and how that would influence the questions which are being asked.
I'm not going to be able to answer the question, but I think somebody else may be able to answer specifically, but I think one of the things that came out of this morning's presentations from Stephen Jenkins and Barbara Moore was, you know, I know about some of the data sets they talked about, but didn't know about the collection of them or how you find out about them. And so Barbara mentioned a study by Maxwell and various others and Peter Huxley in the British Journal of Social Work, which was saying, let's look at the cohort data sets, in the UK and see what they, how useful they can be for social care. Now, maybe somebody's done that for mental health, or maybe you can find some place which will tell you about all the different cohort data sets in a particular area. So, I mean, I don't know if anybody knows of those sort of repositories or the linkages or lists, but that kind of location.
Yeah, I think if you check the UK data archive, there's a link to European data sets, and you can see that there are some, and then you've got these questions for the repository when you check which data set has which questions, but there are some comparable European data, so you can dig there, and they're very helpful. If you send them an email, they can, you know, respond quite quickly as well.
As you were saying, specifically it's the European Quality of Life Survey, the one that has all these questions.
There's only share data, which is an EU older people survey, which is across Europe with similar questions. So, and you find a lot of analysis using shared data, and so it's shorter survey of health and something. So, but it's short. If you just Google shared data EU, you'll find a lot of articles as well. So you can look at what people have done there.
So, health and retirement in Europe.
Yes, that's it.
Yes, just to say, I mean, Shireen has written a methods review for the School for Social Care Research, which is about longitudinal methods, not so much the data sets as such, but there is some useful material in that, so you can get that from the website. And also to say that Raphael was here most of the day, but about the Department of Health. Raphael and Derek at the back there are just in the process of beginning, just about to begin, a School for Social Care Research scoping review, which will list all the data sets which have social care material in them in the UK, and that will be a document that we'll update every so often. So that's only a UK one, and that will pick up on those, some longitudinal one, and it isn't written yet, but it will be at some point. But well, I think in a sense what we can try and do as a school, and if people have got something suggested here, have got links to these or knowledge of these things, it'd be really good to have them, and we'll put a little web page on the website with some of these resources, and you can just click onto them and get into the different links. So we'll definitely do some of that.
Okay, other comments or questions?
First, I apologize for missing some of the sessions. I guess my query is around, it touches on something you mentioned in the summary, Mark, in terms of the difficulties and the challenges in terms of why longitudinal studies haven't been done in social care and some of the reasons for that. And I wonder about some of the contextual issues that are involved and the extent to which a lot of what happens in social care is determined by the current economic situation. And we can think of the current situation as being a perfect example of that. And thinking about sort of Shireen's study, looking at turnover, and you touched on it, and perhaps it's in your method review, thinking about how do you contextualize the results that you get at different points in time in relation to the context that exists at that particular point in time. And are there particular measures that are important to collect in addition to what's available in longitudinal studies that will provide that context? And how far do we go in terms of trying to contextualize the result?
Can I answer? Yeah. I didn't do that because that would be the period effect, which is what's happening outside. Unfortunately, you have to work out that, so it's a date. And I'm not aware of, I haven't read analysis that really linked some of the findings from the policy context. We tend to do that in our work because we fund by the DH and we need to mention policy. But I think it's a very, very important issue. It's got to do with social care and the process that is going on. So, very bad point, but I didn't put it in the ministry. I'm sorry.
We didn't really talk about like early intervention and how that fits into the longitudinal research and what's out there. If there is anything out there, actually, like people followed up that you seek an intervention, if that would be useful at all in terms of prevention or an increasing focus on prevention.
Yes, and I think the issue, the very last word is the one to me that would be important for us to think about. I think that there's always been lots of words spoken about prevention, but not a lot of action necessarily. And we know that preventive initiatives anyway are the ones that often get cut first when resources are very tight. But there could not be any more important time for being able to understand and to implement preventive activities than there is now. So that's exactly the sort of context where you need to have longitudinal data and study designs, and I think you're in the sort of projection to the world that has Louise illustrated, because you know, quite often, as Derek's point as well, the context today will be very different and have quite a bit different bearing on prevention than, say, the context 10 years ago. So data that were initially collected 10 years ago may not be as helpful as you would want for today's circumstances. So I think it's a blending of, you know, the existing data and then the projection techniques to begin to do that. So I think that's a very good way of illustrating it.
I think there's also, I think, some mileage in actually, rather than waiting for the nightly design, you know, cohort surveys to studies to come on stream, is to go and talk to service providers and local authorities. The data quality is always an issue. There's issues about the sampling you're going to have, and etc. But there's, I think there is something that we're very interested in talking to local authorities, because prevention, when you talk about prevention for some of these people, all you might need is 5 years worth of data. You're not talking about prevention for people who are 50, or at least a lot of the prevention is not about that. And so I think there is some mileage in talking to local authorities, talking to try to get there, you know, to help them understand better the data, and as a result getting better data at all. And by definition, it tends to be longitudinal because it is case numbers.
Can I say something to Derek's point? I think there is very room to look at qualitative longitudinal data to answer the, you know, that context. And I think there is a lot of tension at the moment to qualitative, and some of the surveys has introduced qualitative data, and that can be very useful. I think in terms of intervention, there's quite a few evaluations that look at pre-post. And I happen to know a couple of them within social care, but what happens that it's difficult to have the same people. So there are some use of data records and case records to look at. For example, we've done something with children in care and introducing new models of social work, like the social work pilots, and then we can look at the case of certain children and the number of episodes of care, but then things change because they age anyway, and you have to have very accurate data, and this is routinely collected data. So there are issues of how you collect the data, and people tend to have cross-sectional pre and cross-sectional post, and this is a really RCT that we have to call the same person because they have, this is the subject, you know, the body and what change of the related indications. So different papers to agree with that.
Okay, other comments, questions? Talman?
I was just wondering whether perhaps you know, how funding bodies respond to what is data based on longitudinal data analysis, whether there is any preference, whether there, from the experience of anybody else's experience, or there is no really difference when.
I mean, I think funding bodies. I think funding bodies in this country are quite enlightened, and so we've heard this morning, you know, examples of very big investments in longitudinal data sets. I'm sure Tom may have a view, but I think quite often it's sort of, you know, initial wave is funded. You're not sure how many further waves will be funded, but once you've got, if you've got a very good platform of data from the initial wave, then you've got a, you know, quite a strong case, I would have thought, to make for further collections from that sort of source. I want to come back to something else, but Tom,
well, saying. Just to come in, the chief executive of the ESRC is Paul Boyle, and was a Longview trustee, and has himself been a very active player in longitudinal research. And he is very well clued up and very, very supportive of longitudinal research. Plus, there are discussions between MRC, ESRC, and Wellcome on how best to use this. My guess would be, generally, actually got a tremendously strong case for launching a new one. I mean, launching a new one is big, but what would be very appealing to them is our studies which say we want to make use of the data that is there. So secondary analysis of existing longitudinal data sets. My guess is would be very appealing to funders of that kind and to nothing. I might just use this opportunity to say, in case you don't know, that, that on top of the 28 million that's going to the new birth cohort, now called the 2013 or 14 birth cohort, the one that Barbara referred to, the ESRC is putting 5.5 million into a cohort resource facility, is its current name. I don't think it will stay under that name. And I think it's public knowledge that's going to the Centre for Longitudinal Studies at the Institute of Education in just up the road here. And it's Jane Elliott who's in charge of that. And that will kick off, I think they've just got to cross the eyes and so on, but so later this year. And that will be, for those of you that are interested, that it's there to be a resource. I don't mean they can answer all of the questions, but it is there to make it as easy as possible for you to use not just the cohort studies that are in under the Centre for Longitudinal Studies, but actually as many as possible. So it's a little bit off, it'll take a bit of time to get off the ground, but it'll be a very, very important and useful resource for you.
Which is surprising. One other thing, just the Medical Research Council are thinking about investing in a new cohort for people with intellectual disabilities. So they're just at the moment calling for expressions of interest. That's not quite the right term. So they haven't decided yet, but they want to see what might be done. And that's, I think, in recognition of the sort of thing that Barbara talked about this morning, that those are often people who, by dint of their very characteristics, fall out in too big a number out of some existing data sets, whether they're birth cohort or household panel surveys, because those people are either not in a situation where they can complete the data, complete the questionnaires, or they're in some substitute housing setting where they don't get picked up by household surveys. I thought we saw survive 2 or 3 o'clock. Other comments or questions? I just want to make one quick point, which I think could pick up on Tom's point. What I think was very interesting from Shireen's presentation and what Jose Luis was saying as well just now about some of the sort of maybe 5-year relatively short longitudinal studies, that they're both talking about using routinely collected data. So Shireen illustrated, I think with your beautiful slides, which looked like sort of things you're looking at biological labs, those slides illustrate the dirtiness, if you like, the untidiness of administrative data. But there's also tremendous potential with those data because you've got big, big numbers and they're having to come in on regular intervals or come in frequently from the providers. And I think what Jose Luis was talking about when we work with local authorities, that many of those authorities will have increasingly data sets, electronic case records over time, which will give you the opportunity then to do some research in that basis. And then what Barbara and Steve were discussing this morning was using data already in existence in the birth cohorts or in the household panel survey of understanding society, where you can use those out and go and collect new data. And I would say, if anybody is a researcher aged under about 40, I'll be planning now, and that cuts me out by a very, very long way, but I would plan now analyses of the birth cohort data sets when those people reach a stage where they're going to be perhaps potentially heavy users of social care services. So those data sets will be tremendously rich, but it's not quite there yet. ELSA's helpful, but it doesn't go back to birth or to early years for understanding some of the dynamics across the life course. So there's lots of potential with existing data sets as well as thinking about new data sets. It's a very deep round from David at the point there.
Sorry, because I missed a lot of things, but I was thinking that one of the challenges going forward with the data sets is the reforms to the health and social care system in England. Fragmentation potential providers, the greater role of private sector providers. I'm just thinking what that means for continuity in longitudinal data sets, or whether people are looking at that, and whether or not that is in fact an issue or it's a red herring. But it seems to me that that's a whole other dimension. Maybe you talked about that, I don't know.
No, actually, certainly Alison Pollock wrote in the BMJ recently saying that the move to allow people to register with GPs anywhere.
Yeah,
it will certainly have a big implication on that kind of thing for routine GP data and consequences for trying to calculate allocations to localities and GPs and all kinds of things. Mm-hmm. DHH has just published a consultation on an information strategy. I don't know whether it's anything you may, that might be worth a look.
Yeah, which is proposing to cut some of the current data sets. Is that right? Is that still very close? So, I mean, there is a, that's not because of the integration, but for other reasons. Okay, any other comments or questions, Deborah?
I'm never going to be qualified to be involved in using these data sets directly, but I'm quite interested in, I think governments are quite interested and influenced by them, and I've been to a number of presentations where a model has been put forward to how we understand either the data that has been collected or how we extrapolate it into the future. And it strikes me that the quality assurance of that kind of process is quite a specialist field. Which, you know, government civil servants are normally, you know, quite persuaded by it. They understand the steps, but they don't understand the assumptions behind it and how, you know, how concrete they might be. So if you fiddle around with this bit, then that bit's going to change dramatically. So I don't really know what my comment is, but I think at Sky we will probably never have someone who will be, you know, who will be an in-house specialist in this field. And in order to understand some of the material in the published peer-reviewed journal articles, you know, we would need some sort of assistance with quality assuring that, and you know, this is not like a real useful, you know, conclusions and findings that have been drawn. So
do you mean quality assurance of the data, or of the analysis, or of the service?
Well, it would be both, because it's at each stage. But at the end of it, if you want to rely on, I mean, I guess we're interested in findings. And I'm thinking particularly in the field of, well, just an example, we've done quite a lot of work on looked after children. And I don't think that we have anyone in-house who would be able to look at some of the longitudinal studies that deal with that. That would be able to, taking into account the changing context that David's talked about, etc. So I don't know whether there's, you know, opportunities for partnerships or, you know, are people who do this kind of work. It's such short supply in social care that, you know, we find a problem, you know, finding someone to speak to them.
Actually, just to give you an example, DH, for example, asked the IFS to look at the model. Because it is precisely those questions, because mm-hmm. you know, it's very good, you know, all these results, but it's quite complicated to know whether this is reliable or not, and therefore they had to subcontract the IFS to look at the model. So, you know, those partnerships are possible.
Mm-hmm. And I also think, I mean, the nature of the analysis, I mean, both Shireen and Nesli illustrated this very well, and Stephen and Barbara didn't talk about it in detail, but behind their papers will be the same point, that these are complicated. These are very complicated designs, and the analysis that's needed in these designs is itself very complicated. And so it's much harder, I think, for the lay reader to get into understanding the methods and appreciate the methods that are used in these studies than it may be for quite a lot of other research that's out there. So I think it is inherently complicated. And, you know, there may be a bit of jiggery pokery going in there as well, but it's inherently complicated, and it does need more translation of those pieces of evidence into the implications for policymakers or practitioners. So I think your point is a very, very good one. Okay, any more comments or questions?
This is a bit of a minority one, and I meant to ask you after your presentation. You talked about reweighting the samples to reflect the general population. What does that mean?
It just means that when you look at you just say, okay, so how many, what proportion of all the people have I got? Well, they're all older people. What proportion of men of certain age groups with a certain wealth, with certain disability? You look for information from other sources about what those should look like. Mm-hmm. And then you reweight, you basically place different importance on different cases within your sample so that when you actually look at those descriptions, they look like the population.
Looks so like you might magnify that material as though it applies to six people instead of one person.
But you use the relative weights as such that it then looks like a random sample of.
It's basically what I say, that one person may represent more than one or half the one, half mm-hmm. one. So it depends if you. But they have rules. You can't just have one to represent 20. You have rules behind the scene. But it's basically that if you undersampled, for example, very young women on 20, but you needed 30, so these 20 would have more weight in your sample as 30, and then the other ones were all opposite, so you'd have less. So it's basically the importance of each individual response would be different.
it's an example of rules that are kind of, you know, quite obscure to know.
Okay, I'm going to, I want to say four things to finish off. One is sort of an apology to many people probably aren't, who aren't here. We did longitudinal analysis. We really looked at quantitative. We looked at qualitative, of course, or mixed methods. Mixed methods, I guess, was coming in a bit in the last presentations. And there is a tradition of qualitative longitudinal research as well, of course. So that's something which I think if SSCR or somebody else is going to take this forward, we want to make sure we looked at. So just to say, this is a very relatively narrow look at quite a big issue. So that's number one. Number two is a request and invitation. If anybody fancies writing a blog for us for the School for Social Care Research on today or on bits of today, we'd be delighted. Mike and I, you can contact, be delighted to hear about. So if there's something that particularly fires you up and you want to write about it, it'd be great. I think what we'll try and do is put something together anyway over time to put together some links, the sort of things that are being talked about today, some of the papers that are being talked about, so we can maybe put those together into a blog. Third thing to say is would be great to have feedback from you. We're not giving you a feedback form, but if there are comments you want to make, please don't hesitate to send them through to us, the people you've been in email contact with. And then finally, a thank you to Tom, who suggested this in the first place and came to us. So delighted to have had this partnership. To the four speakers who each gave us brilliant presentations. And as I say, we'll get their slides onto the website. And thanks to you for coming along and taking part in the debate. So I hope it's going to be helpful to you, as I'm sure it'll be helpful to us. So thank you very much.